Therapist Clint Matheny has this quote that I think might completely change how you view yourself.
Oh, yeah, it's a powerful one.
Right. He writes, "We're children pretending to be adults. Most of us just don't realize it."
It really kind of stops you in your tracks.
It does. And well, welcome to this deep dive, because today we're going to dismantle the hidden childhood commands that are just, quietly driving your reactions, your stress, your daily habits.
Exactly. If you're someone who feels stuck in the exact same emotional loops year after year, this is for you.
Yeah, we're exploring Matheny's clinical framework. It's called Imperative Self-Analysis, or ISA. And our mission today is to figure out how to actually turn that emotional autopilot off.
Which is huge, because the part of you doing the pretending in that quote, that's what Matheny calls the imperative self,
Right.
it's basically an unconscious emotional system running entirely beneath your awareness. And it shapes, how you perceive the world, your identity, the behaviors you engage in every single day.
And all without your conscious permission, right?
Absolutely zero permission.
I keep picturing this like a smartphone operating system.
Well, that's a good way to look at it.
Like, you don't see the code, you don't even realize iOS or Android is running in the background while you're scrolling, but it is entirely dictating how your battery drains, which apps function, how the device responds.
Yeah, it's the foundational layer.
Exactly. We have this invisible operating system for our emotional states. It's just draining our battery and dictating our reactions before our conscious brain even logs on.
And, Matheny had a massive realization in his own clinical practice about that exact operating system.
What was it?
Well, for a decade, he did what his traditional training taught him. He tried to help his clients succeed at their emotional obsessions.
Meaning he was trying to make them better at being anxious or driven.
Right, like trying to code a better, smoother, imperative self so people could function highly in their daily lives. But the revelation was, and this is key, nobody actually needs an imperative self.
Wait, nobody needs it?
No. People don't need these rigid emotional obsessions at all. Underneath all the striving and the coping mechanisms, what people are desperately looking for isn't a better personality.
Then what is it?
It's just peace.
Just peace? Wow. Which sounds like the ultimate goal, but I guess we have to understand the code before we can delete the program, right?
Exactly. We have to look at why we react the way we do.
So, tracing this back to 1988, therapist Leslie Cameron Bandler developed the foundation of this ISA framework to answer two fundamental mysteries.
Right, the big questions of human behavior.
Yeah. First, why do people react completely differently to the exact same event? And second, why do some clients keep reliving the same emotions over and over without ever finding resolution?
And the answer she arrived at is this mechanism called the virtual question.
The virtual question.
Yes, it's a silent command formed very early in life, almost always before the age of eight.
So we're talking really young kids here.
Super young. A child experiences an emotionally charged or traumatic moment, right?
Okay.
And the young brain has to figure out a way to survive it.
Right.
But a 5 to 7 year old brain doesn't have the cognitive maturity to process like complex emotional nuance. It relies on a very simple binary survival algorithm.
And that algorithm is focused on three specific verbs, if I remember the source material correctly: do, be, or get.
Exactly. Do, be, or get.
Let's ground this in reality, because do, be, or get sounds a little abstract.
Sure.
Let's imagine a hypothetical listener. We'll call her Sarah. Say Sarah is a highly successful 35-year-old project manager. She's a relentless overachiever, but also a chronic people pleaser.
Okay, classic profile.
If we look at the do category, maybe at age six, she had highly volatile parents. So her childhood brain might have formed the virtual question: what do I have to do to keep the adults calm?
Yes, exactly. Or if we look at the B category, someone who experienced early abandonment might form the question, what do I have to be to ensure people don't leave me?
Oh, wow.
Right. And that manifests in adulthood as the ultimate chameleon personality. They just become whoever the room needs them to be.
And the get category.
What do I have to get to be safe? Which turns into the adult who relentlessly hoards resources or money or social status.
That's fascinating.
And that silent command becomes the filter for the rest of their life. It dictates an individual's entire emotional palette, locking them into a menu of about 5 to 7 core emotions they repeat every single day.
Like their unique emotional fingerprint.
Exactly.
Okay, wait, I have to push back here for a second.
Go for it.
Because if my core emotions and the recurring themes of my life, like my drive, my empathy, my need to keep the peace, if you're saying those are just an algorithm, aren't those things simply my personality?
I hear that all the time.
Right. Yeah. Like, if Sarah is a naturally driven person who gets a little anxious about deadlines, isn't that just who she is? It sounds like you're saying a person's actual personality is just a glitch.
I know, and it's totally natural to feel protective of those traits because we build our entire adult identities around them.
Yeah, and we get rewarded for them.
Oh, big time. Society rewards Sarah for being a relentless overachiever. But Matheny's framing draws a really hard line here.
Which is what?
The personality driven by those repetitive, compulsory emotions isn't the real you. It's an outdated survival program pretending to be a personality.
Pretending?
Yeah. It was built to protect a child, but you are not a child anymore. Clinically, when the nervous system no longer has to brace itself against that original childhood trauma, those default emotional states just stop showing up.
Wait, really? They just stop?
You don't manage them. They literally vanish.
Okay, if the compulsory parts of our personality are just this outdated survival algorithm, how do we actually find our specific code?
Well, Matheny has a homework assignment for his clients, and honestly, anyone listening can start this today.
Oh, I like actionable stuff. What is it?
You track your 5 to 7 most common emotions over a 7-day period.
Okay, just write down what I feel for a week.
Yes, but it cannot be just any week. It has to be a mundane, everyday baseline week.
Oh, so no tracking while I'm on a tropical vacation in Hawaii.
Exactly. Or starting a new job,
yeah.
Or right after a breakup. You are looking for the emotions quietly dominating normal life.
Okay, that makes sense.
The challenge, though, is identifying what Matheny calls hidden emotions.
Which is incredibly difficult because we disguise them as productivity or routine.
Totally.
Think about Sarah, our project manager. She's sitting at her desk on a random Tuesday at 2 p.m. She's completely absorbed in a spreadsheet.
Right.
If you interrupt her and ask how she feels, she'd probably say, I'm just focused. I'm working.
But that's not the real emotion.
Exactly. If she puts that feeling under a microscope, the emotion running the show isn't focus. It might be this low-grade dread of dropping a ball or the scarcity of time, that ticking clock feeling.
Yes. The strict rule for this homework is tracking the underlying emotion, not the behavior.
Right.
Working hard is a behavior. The anxiety of not being good enough, driving the work that is the emotion you track.
It's kind of like tracking your financial spending for a month to see where your money actually goes.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
You might sit down on the 31st and be shocked to realize you're spending 80% of your daily emotional budget on low-grade panic or frustration. You just didn't notice because it felt normal to your nervous system.
Yeah, you are blindly allocating precious cognitive resources to those states.
Wow.
But there is a crucial clinical warning Matheny adds to this step.
Okay, what's the catch?
The tracking exercise fails completely if the individual isn't brutally honest with themselves about their true emotions. And we are exceptionally skilled at lying to ourselves.
That's true. We like to think we're fine.
Right. And Matheny also notes in his writings that he sees mixed results with clients who are currently taking certain medications.
Oh, like what?
Specifically, SSRIs, benzodiazepines, antipsychotics, or even stimulants like Adderall.
Why is that? Do they interfere with the process?
Yeah, these medications fundamentally alter the chemical and emotional baseline. They either numb or shift the exact emotions the ISA process is trying to identify.
Got it. Okay, so let's say Sarah does the homework. She's brutally honest. She maps out her 5 emotions, recognizing that her daily budget is mostly spent on anxiety, urgency, and this weird underlying guilt.
Okay.
She walks into the clinic with her data. What is the actual mechanism of the therapy? Because from the sources, this isn't years of weekly sessions where you recount your bad dates or stressful meetings.
No, not really.
It's a 2 to 3 hour initial session, right? And at the end, the client gets this concise 40-word ISA map summarizing their entire unconscious program.
Yeah, it's just one session.
Mm-hmm.
The mechanism in that room is fundamentally different from traditional talk therapy.
How so?
Well, there's a common misconception that deep psychological healing requires dragging a person through the mud of their worst memories, like forcing them to relive the trauma to process it.
Yeah, which sounds exhausting.
It is. But ICE is designed to be entirely non-re-traumatizing. It uses the client's historical moments of strength as an anchor to safely explore the structure of the trauma.
Okay, what does that actually look like in practice? Does the therapist ask the client to remember a time they felt powerful at age 6 and use that feeling to approach the memory?
Precisely. Before even touching the traumatic event that formed the virtual question, the therapist guides the client to identify a specific visceral memory from their early childhood, where they felt completely safe, capable, and autonomous.
Oh, I see.
The client anchors deeply into the physical sensation of that safety.
Uh-huh.
And only while holding on to that grounded, empowered state do they gently look at the structure of the traumatic memory.
So they aren't reliving the pain.
No, they are analyzing the architecture of the event from a position of absolute safety.
That's amazing. And the tool they use to analyze that architecture without contaminating it is something you mentioned earlier, clean language.
Yes, clean language.
This emerged in the mid-1990s, and Matheny credits it with making IRIS truly effective. I want to make sure we understand this. How does a therapist accidentally contaminate a memory, and how does clean language prevent that?
Think about standard talk therapy. If Sarah says, "I have this heavy feeling in my chest when I think about my dad."
Right.
A well-meaning therapist might ask, "Does that heavy feeling make you feel scared? Is it sadness?"
Okay, yeah, that sounds normal.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
But the therapist has just introduced their own vocabulary, scared or sadness, into the client's mental map. They're leading the witness.
Oh, wow. I never thought about that.
Clean language strips all the therapist's assumptions out. A clean question would be, "And what kind of heavy is that heavy?" Or, "And is there anything else about that heavy feeling in your chest?"
So it only uses the client's exact words.
Exactly. Allowing the unconscious mind to reveal its own structure without any outside interference.
That linguistic precision seems totally vital if you're trying to isolate a specific childhood algorithm.
It really is.
And looking at the real-world results Matheny shares, they are staggering.
Yeah, the case studies are wild.
Like, there's a 65-year-old man named Bill who said that looking back at his old emotion list, he literally couldn't find those feelings anymore. He described it as feeling born again.
Incredible.
Or Robin, a 32-year-old whose daily emotional baseline was anxiety, fear, and frustration. After ISA, her baseline shifted to purposeful, hopeful, and connected.
And then there's Bobby.
Right, Bobby. Over 29 months, she saw her default states of anger and overwhelm entirely transform into gratitude and awe.
Those transformations really speak to the permanence of the shift.
But, I mean, I'm reading these case studies thinking, 2 to 3 hours. 2 to 3 hours to undo decades of an emotional autopilot.
It sounds impossible.
How is that practically possible when standard therapies can take a decade and people still walk around feeling like they're just white-knuckling their anxiety?
It's because it fundamentally changes the target of the therapy.
Yeah.
Most standard modalities focus on managing symptoms.
Like breathing exercises.
Right. They give you breathing exercises for the anxiety or cognitive reframes for the anger. They're basically selling you an endless subscription to antivirus software to quarantine a corrupted file on your hard drive.
But the virus is still there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're just using a lot of processing power to keep it contained. ISA deletes the corrupted file.
Oh, I love that analogy.
It targets the root structure, the historical event, and the virtual question that built the emotional map. When that root traumatic structure is healed, the entire architecture of the imperative self loses its purpose.
So the symptoms vanish because the mechanism generating them has been uninstalled.
Precisely.
Okay, let's talk about the industry then. If pulling the weed by the root takes 3 hours, why is the global mental health industry still overwhelmingly selling lawnmowers to trim the top?
That's the million-dollar question.
Seriously. If ISA is this rapid and gentle, why isn't it the standard of psychological care everywhere?
Matheny actually outlines 5 specific reasons ISA isn't mainstream.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, the original training in the late 80s and 90s was highly inaccessible. It required 24 days of grueling instruction.
24 days?
Yes, spread across 6 weekends, which was incredibly expensive and time-consuming for working therapists.
No, yeah, I can see how that's a barrier.
Second, as we touched on, the early intervention tools were just inadequate. Until clean language emerged to provide that linguistic precision, dismantling these maps was much harder and less consistent.
And the third reason is just a massive PR problem.
Oh, totally. Marketing rapid personality change is incredibly difficult.
Because society has been conditioned by pop culture and decades of traditional psychology to believe that meaningful healing must be a long, painful, drawn-out process.
Right. If a practitioner claims they can shift your core emotional baseline in a 3-hour afternoon session, people immediately assume it's snake oil.
It just sounds too good to be true.
Exactly. The fourth reason is just a systemic reality of any profession. Therapists get comfortable.
Oh, for sure.
They build entire practices around methodologies they know. There's a natural human reluctance to step entirely outside of your professional comfort zone to learn a totally new, highly technical paradigm.
That makes sense. And the fifth reason?
The fifth reason Matheny identifies is the financial disincentive. If successful ISE cures a person quickly, leading to a much shorter duration of therapy.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, that directly translates to a significantly shorter revenue stream for the therapist.
Okay, I have to pause on that last point.
I figured you might.
Because suggesting that therapists are avoiding a cure just to keep billing clients for years feels highly cynical. It sounds like an accusation that the mental health profession is intentionally keeping people sick.
I get why it sounds that way, but looking closely at the source material, Matheny isn't framing this as intentional malice. It's not some shadowy conspiracy of greedy practitioners.
Okay, then what is it?
It's about systemic inertia and a massive paradigm clash. The prevailing belief in the mental health industry genuinely views psychological care as a lifelong management tool.
Right.
The entire infrastructure, from university training to insurance billing, is built on a model of ongoing support. ISA views therapy as a structural teardown.
It's the difference between a doctor prescribing a daily pill for a chronic condition versus a surgeon performing a one-time operation.
Yes. And the current industry is simply not built for surgeons.
That distinction makes a lot of sense. It's the machinery of the industry, not malice.
Exactly. And Matheny actually puts his money where his mouth is when it comes to this paradigm shift.
Oh, how so?
His pricing model completely subverts standard therapy billing. He charges a flat $1,000 for that initial 2 to 3 hour session. But
what?
You only pay after the session if you are entirely satisfied with the result.
Wait, really?
Really. And even wilder, if you need follow-up sessions which run at $200 an hour, that payment is deferred. You don't pay for follow-ups until your emotional patterns actually stop activating automatically.
Wow. So he literally ties his compensation to the permanent structural change in the client.
Yeah. It aligns the financial incentive directly with rapid, verifiable healing.
That is incredible confidence in the method.
It really is.
So bringing this all back to you, the listener, if you are exhausted, if you feel like you're doing everything right, the morning journaling, the self-help books, the standard therapy, but you are still stuck in the same emotional loops you can't even name.
You are not breaking.
Exactly. There is nothing fundamentally wrong with your brain. You are simply running an autopilot script, a survival algorithm written by a 7-year-old version of yourself who was just doing the absolute best they could to keep you safe in a confusing world.
And peace is not an emotion you have to aggressively hunt down or hustle for or force into existence.
No.
Peace is simply what naturally remains when your nervous system finally stops bracing against the past. Once you identify that hidden code and turn off the imperative self, the noise just stops.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final thought to explore on your own. Think about those core personality traits you hold so closely. Your intense drive, your specific brand of self-deprecating humor, your perfectionism, or maybe your role as the family peacekeeper.
Yeah.
If those traits were largely built as a childhood survival strategy to answer a silent virtual question, who would you actually be if you completely forgot the question? Who is the adult underneath the child pretending to be an adult?
That is the ultimate question.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Tomorrow, when you find yourself reacting to a sudden email, traffic, or a passing comment, just take a second to observe your emotional autopilot. See if you can spot the code. Take care, and we'll catch you next time.